This is Patrick Wannis, Human Behavior and Relationship Expert, PhD. In the 21st century, with the extraordinary advancements we have in technology, information, we would expect to be extremely healthy. And yet, in the United States alone, the most prescribed nation in the world, spending the most amount of money on healthcare, the U.S. remains number 36 on the list of the healthiest nations in the world, even behind Cuba and Iran. So what is the real approach to health? What are we doing wrong? Is it because we're treating the symptom and not the cause? What do we need to do to change our lifestyle and to take charge of our health? One of my clients recently began working with a new doctor, and this doctor was able to identify her core problem relating to adrenal exhaustion and an extraordinary hormonal imbalance, most of which I've been telling her about for a long time, but she didn't recognize until she went to a specialist. That doctor is Dr. Michael Bauer-Schmidt. Dr. Bauer-Schmidt is a doctor in functional medicine, and he has a practice, Full Potential Healthcare, based in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Dr. Mike, thank you very much for being available, and it's very interesting that we share a client. I refer to her as a client, you refer to her as a patient, obviously. And it took her a long time to actually get it, which is that she needed to change her lifestyle, needed to address her serious stress issues and the actual causes, which include adrenal exhaustion. So I'm really happy that she found you, so thank you very much. Just to begin, though, what is functional medicine?
Well, Patrick, thanks for having me, first of all. And, you know, surprisingly, or not surprisingly, a number of patients come into me and as a referral from another source, and things that they've been telling them for years just don't make sense until they hear it from somebody with an MD behind their name. Functional medicine is, you know, traditionally medicine is, from the allopathic point of view, you come in, you have a symptom, the doctor asks you a bunch of questions, he comes up with a diagnosis, and he writes you a prescription. Well, to me, that's only part of the problem. Functional medicine looks beyond the symptom complex to find out the cause of the problem. And once you find the cause of the problem, let's deal with the cause as opposed to simply putting a Band-Aid on the symptom.
Your approach is exactly the same approach that I do in my clients. I never treat the symptoms. I look for the root cause. So whatever your behavior is, I'm looking at what's driving the behavior versus trying to teach you how to manage your anger. I want to find out, what are you angry about? What are the emotions beneath the anger? What's truly creating the problems for you that's motivating you to act this way? So there's an interesting parallel between what you've just defined as functional medicine.
What we're looking for in functional medicine is, it's not that we are not sick because of karma, because of a germ, because of our genes. Our manifestation of our current health is based on our body doing the best it can with what we've been giving it to work with. So if our body's not working well, we got to look at what haven't we been giving it? What's it need in order to function more properly? If your engine was missing and sputtering, wouldn't you take it to the mechanic and expect him to fix, you know, find the reason it's sputtering and whatever, as opposed to just revving it up a little bit?
How did you go from being a traditional doctor to being a doctor of functional medicine?
I was failed by the traditional medicine system. I had a car accident coming. I'd worked for 25 years in the emergency room, and I was coming home from work one morning and got in a rear-end collision on I-95, which is our major interstate here in Fort Lauderdale, and blew out some discs in my neck and my spine. And, of course, I went to see the neurologist, who sent me to the neurosurgeon, who sent me to the physiatrist, who sent me to the anesthesiologist, and I got my long and short-acting narcotics and my muscle relaxants and my anti-inflammatories and eventually my antidepressants and my sleeping pills, and none of it really worked, along with all the injections and the stuff. And it wasn't working, and so they finally said, well, let's do a procedure. And I just went, well, procedures always fix everything, according to my training. And so I agreed, and sure enough, it worked for, about a week. And then I had progressive pain, and the symptoms got worse and worse until I ended up in the hospital, unable to even lift my foot 6 inches to step into the shower to wash myself.
sorry to jump in there, but what was the actual problem? You said you dislocated or you ruptured or you damaged
there,
the brain.
Yeah, I had five different disc rupture as a result of the accident. Three in my neck and two in my low back. And so they did a procedure on the low back because that was the one that seemed to be the most bothersome. And it was supposed to be a really simple procedure. Just stick a needle in there and make the gelatinous portion of the disc vaporize, and that made the fibrous portion pull back off and take the pressure off the nerve. And it worked really great for a week. And then I had progressive pain, and they ended up putting me in a hospital because it wasn't being controlled with anything I was taking orally. And eventually they diagnosed an infection in the disc and the bone. And they spent 3 weeks on IV morphine, IV Ativan, oral medications as well, and then 6 weeks of IV antibiotics. And by the time I was done with that whole program, I was worse off than when I started.
You just said that you were worse off than when you began. So what do you mean by that?
That means my pain was worse than when I started. I had less mobility than when I started, than when I had the accident. If somebody said, we can take you back to the time of your accident and have that pain back or have the pain I was in, I would have taken the pain from the acute accident, hands down.
And how much time had passed between the accident and the point which you're referring to?
That was 2 years.
So in 2 years of traditional Western medicine procedures, you got worse.
Oh, yeah.
I am pausing because I'm completely stunned by this story.
Mm-hmm.
So then what happened?
Well, then what happened is I happened to run into, not literally, but figuratively, I'd had enough accidents. I ran into a fellow I used to work with in the emergency room who had opened an anti-aging practice in a town nearby. And he said, Mike, let me give you some IV vitamin C. And I remember very clearly looking at him and said, Mark, I thought you were a doctor. And he said, I am. Let me give you some IV vitamin C. What have you got to lose? And I went, okay, you're right. I don't have anything to lose. And so after the third infusion, this was over a course of about a week and a half, but after the third infusion, I remember very clearly walking out to my car, and I went to open my car door, and I noticed that for the first time in what was now almost 3 years since the original accident, I remembered what it was like not to be in constant pain.
There are lots of people listening right now who instantly relate to the concept of being in constant pain,
mm-hmm.
and very few people ever get past that. So there are extraordinary amounts of people who are in constant pain. You just said that an IV of vitamin C shifted your pain.
Yep, absolutely. There was nothing else that changed in anything that I did, and there's no question that walking out of that office, I experienced for the first time in almost 3 years, a pain-free interval.
So here is a doctor of traditional Western medicine, an MD, who has an accident, goes
mm-hmm.
through all the potential possible procedures available, whatever, there were surgeries, operations, procedures,
mm-hmm.
treatments, none of which work. You find an anti-aging doctor who says the most extraordinary thing, how about an IV of vitamin C? I've never even heard of that. And then you're telling me that that removed the pain.
That's what I'm telling you.
I'm still in shock. What happened next?
Well, what happened next is I just went, there's something more going on here than what meets the eye, and I committed myself to learning as much as I could, or rather relearning, because there's nothing I've learned subsequent to medical school that I haven't learned in functional medicine. Is just how I applied the knowledge.
What you've said is significant, because you're saying that it wasn't about learning new things, it was about applying what you've learned in a different way.
Exactly.
Okay.
Biochemistry is biochemistry. And once you understand, and we, really what we are is just a walking, talking biochemistry machine. And what I've come to appreciate is that, as I mentioned earlier in trying to define functional medicine, we are basically a manifestation of what we have given our body to work with. But there's a thing underlying all this called oxidative stress, and it just occurs naturally. It's the result of the energy production that we undergo on a daily basis to power our biochemistry. And every time we create a molecule of energy, we create a free radical. This free radical is oxidizing. It rusts us, which is why we can't live forever.
What is oxidative stress?
Oxidative stress is in our body's ability to generate energy. We have this thing called the redox reaction. This is basic chemistry. Reduction and oxidation. On the reduction side of the equation are things that can donate an electron. They're also called nutrients or antioxidants. On the oxidative side, the rusting side of the equation, we have those things that need an electron. And they're also called free radicals or toxins. When we generate, when that electron is exchanged, we generate energy in the form of ATP and cyclic AMP and the little molecules of energy our body needs. However, every time we generate that molecule of energy, we also generate another free radical. So under the best of circumstances, we're going to slowly rust. But we should last for 120 years before our rust gets so bad that we actually die.
To try and break that down in simple terms, you're saying that the very nature of the way the body functions, the way that the body operates on a daily basis, is also working against us?
Yeah, eventually that's why we can't live forever. As yet, because we haven't figured out how to stop the rust process.
So whilst our body is functioning, it's also producing free radicals, which are toxins or poisons, correct?
Correct. Because there are four general areas that will dramatically increase the rate at which we rust, which is why we're only living to 60, 70, maybe 80 years old. And why many of those last years are spent in a nursing home or in some other extended care facility. And those four areas are what I call my deep approach to medicine. And the deep stands for diet, emotions, environment, and physical. That's how patients are treated in this office, is we go through the deep approach and figure out what it is their body's either missing or what it's got too much of in the way of toxins, and help the body get rid of it or adapt to the presence. D stands for diet. E is for emotion. The second E is for environment. And the P is for physical.
Diet, emotion, environment, and physicality.
Physical. And physicality. And if you want to look at it from a toxin standpoint, is you can put toxin on the end of each of those: dietary toxins, emotional toxins, environmental toxins, and physical toxins.
Give me an example of a physical toxin.
Physical toxins are things that are already wrong with you. Things like that often go unnoticed in traditional medicine. Things like functional hypothyroidism. You know, this is the classic, gee, I'm tired all the time, my hair is falling out. Yes, but your numbers are all normal. Well, I'm sorry, if your hair is falling out, your eyebrows are thin, you're gaining weight, and you got no energy, you've got a thyroid problem. Again, and another one would be adrenals. You know, adrenal dysfunction is very common in this office. There's not anybody in here who's gut is working properly, whose diet is good, and whose adrenals are humming along very swimmingly. Adrenal malfunction is probably the core of a lot of our problems, and it is directly related to emotional toxins.
But the physical toxin is different to the environmental toxin.
Yeah. Wow. Now, when I say physical toxins, I'm also talking about things like the, you know, things that are already broken on you. So your hormones are out of balance. You got, you know, men with low testosterone, women it's the perimenopause thing. Most everybody in this country, it's adrenal stress, functional hypothyroidism, hypertension, hypercholesterolemia, which by itself is not an issue, by the way, but that's a whole other topic of discussion. You know, cholesterol is not the enemy. Cholesterol is your friend. So, you know, overweight, metabolic syndrome, all these things are that are demanding the body engage in maintaining rather than growth and repair. So those are kind of your physical toxins, as opposed to environmental toxins, which are all the heavy metals, the 800,000 different chemicals that have been invented since the 1900s that are just rampant through our atmosphere, our water, and our food supply, pesticides, herbicides, plasticizers, phthalates, volatile organic compounds, diesel exhaust particles, polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, new car smells, carpeting, paints on the walls. I mean, it's not a question of are we toxic. It's the question is really how toxic are we and how is it affecting our life?
Are you saying then the physicality is what's already going on with our body?
Yes.
Correct?
Correct.
The environment is everything that's happening to us from outside of our body. That could be the air, that could be the water, that could be whatever heavy metals are in the food supply. The next is the emotions, which is what are we thinking, what are we feeling, which is obviously one of my areas of expertise.
Exactly.
And I'm always asking people, always trying to get to the root cause of my client, what are your thoughts, what are your beliefs, how do you perceive the world around you, how do you interact with the people and the world around you.
Mm-hmm.
Then the final one, which is the letter D, is diet. And now what you're referring to here is what is the fuel that you're giving your body?
Exactly.
So what are we bringing into the body? What emotions and thoughts are going on in the body? What else is happening in the environment that's affecting our body as well as potentially our emotions?
Mm-hmm.
And then finally, what state is our body presently in, whether that's a genetic state or whether it's just right at this moment your body has low thyroid, has adrenal exhaustion, your hormones are out of balance, etc. Is
exactly.
that summation correct?
That's correct. Yep, that's a very nice summation.
All right.
And that and
so,
that all together is what is manifesting your current state of health.
Let me ask you this. I'm curious. Are you a pariah in your field? Because you're coming from... I've become renowned for being very critical of antidepressants. And yes, I understand that there are some, in some cases, it has saved people's lives in a crisis. But just today it was announced that there was a Dallas Sunday school teacher who committed suicide just after he tried to kill his wife or stab his wife. And it's now being found that he was on Zolzapem, I think it is, which is another name or a generic name for Ambien. It's a,
mm-hmm.
Right. And I have numerous clients who've had extraordinary, horrible experiences with Ambien.
Mm-hmm.
Jack Nicholson, the famous actor, warned
mm-hmm.
Heath Ledger about taking Ambien. He said, don't take it. And Jack Nicholson told Heath Ledger of an experience he had where he was on Ambien and he was driving and he almost ran off a cliff and he didn't even know he was in the car driving.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah,
I've had clients tell me that, yeah, that they're on Ambien,
mm-hmm.
and it's not until the next morning that someone else tells them, you were doing this last night, and that person yeah. says, no, I was asleep.
Yeah, I've had patients tell me things just like that. Like, I went to bed, and the house was a mess, and the next morning I woke up, and everything was clean and neat, and dinner was, and the plate was set for a six-course dinner.
Wow.
And somebody must have broken into my house because I don't remember doing it.
I have a client that unfortunately would tell stories that the next morning her husband, her children were telling her that she was walking around the house naked at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
And she has no recollection. So my point is, unfortunately, the way that medicine has evolved today in the West is that it's purely focused on treating the symptoms and it's not about treating the cause. And that's very different to the way that medicine originally began, which was really about looking at the whole person and particularly looking at something that we're going to get to talk about in a moment, which is about food, that the food is the fuel.
Yeah, Hippocrates said, let food be your medicine, let medicine be your food.
Right. I didn't have that quote, but that's what I was reaching for.
Yeah, yeah. It was only in the 1900s when Abraham Flexner and John D. Rockefeller got together with the AMA to standardize medical school education that was not taught. And there's a whole story behind that if you're interested.
I'm realizing as we speak that we could talk about this for hours. And I really want to get some of the powerful information out to help people because you've just identified a beautiful blend of, I guess, Western medicine and maybe even Eastern in the sense of looking at the whole person, looking at the diet. Mm-hmm. I've had a lot of experience with traditional Chinese medicine because it's been very helpful to me.
Mm-hmm.
And there, they talk about the food that you eat. There, they talk about the herbs. They look at you as a whole person. And interestingly, for example, one Chinese doctor that I went to said to me, don't worry about what you eat, just make sure you eat all five colors, for example, meaning mm-hmm. eat a little bit of everything. And one of the Chinese doctors that I attend to is a Western-trained doctor and a Chinese-trained doctor. So he's able to combine both. But what you're doing is unique, and you're bringing it back to what it originally was when you said, let food heal you, let food be your medicine.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe we can record a separate interview just on adrenal exhaustion and talk a little bit more about the kind of recommendations that you give to people when you're talking about the diet, emotions, the environment, and the physicality.
Diet is to me, until you fix that, you're just banging your head up against the wall. Because your diet is what your body is going to be, the fuel for your body. It's going to have all the vitamins and minerals and nutrients, which are all the cofactors that your body needs in order for it to produce energy and to maintain its basic functions. The big enemy here is processed foods. And you can know a processed food very easily because if what you're about to put in your mouth, if it doesn't look like it did when it was growing on a plant or on a tree, it's been processed. And when you process a food, you take the nutrients out of it. As an example, if you were to eat a fresh orange picked off the tree in your backyard, you're going to get 100% of the calories and 100% of the nutrients. If you decide, you know, I'm tired of picking the fruit and all that stuff, I'm going to do fresh frozen orange juice concentrate. It's just so much easier. All they did is juiced it and froze it. 100% of the calories, 50% of the nutrients. Now if you say, well, gee, I just want to be like every other American and open up the jug of orange juice in the refrigerator, I won't use any brand names, and pour a glass, you get 100% of the calories and 10% of the nutrients. Well, remember back to what I said about the redox equation? The things that can donate electrons are also called nutrients. And if you don't have the nutrients, not only are you robbing your body the ability to take the food that you eat and turn it into energy for your body, you're also robbing it of a source of antioxidants to help eliminate that oxidative stress that you're generating just from eating. So just getting rid of processed foods can be enormously helpful in terms of improving your health. The other thing about diet is that to try to make sure that your blood sugar remains stable throughout the day. And this is where, you know, it's if you want to lose weight, you get rid of processed foods, you have some raw vegetables and protein for breakfast and lunch, you have cooked vegetables in either a protein or a complex starch for dinner, you have fruit as a snack, and when you come into this office, I even give you an eating plan that's based on this. And you even get to have 70% or greater cocoa, organic chocolate as a snack in the afternoon, which will help curb your carb cravings and also increase your serotonin levels for your sense of well-being.
Is that so, why people crave dark chocolate?
One of the reasons. Another reason
is... Well, because
is,
you
is
just to, said... You you just said it boosts the serotonin levels. So the concept of, oh, I lack love, I need the love of chocolate, is that it's actually making you feel better.
Quite possibly. Because you know why hotels leave chocolates on your beds at night? It's not because they're trying to make you feel warm and fuzzy. Well, they are, but not towards them. But tryptophan, which is the precursor to serotonin, which is the precursor to melatonin, you know, serotonin is your feel-good hormone, melatonin is the help-you-sleep hormone, it's selected for uptake into the brain at a higher rate when in the presence of glucose. So you raise the glucose level before you go to bed, you raise your serotonin levels through the provided you've got enough tryptophan running around. But that's why
I'm very
much
sugar.
Yep. And what
so you're saying the combination of sugar and chocolate?
Well, now natural sugars now. And please don't go out and buy yourself a pack of the processed stuff.
Okay.
You got to remember that blood, you know, people measure their blood sugar levels. Sugars are sucrose, fructose, galactose, glucose, you know, there's oses on the end usually mean sugar. So you got the good sugars and you got the not so good sugars. But basically you're correct. If you have something sweet, you're increasing your uptake of tryptophan, which is the precursor to serotonin, which is what your brain needs to make the, you know, which is what your brain needs to feel good.
You mentioned, Dr. Mike, that you offer a food plan to your patients, but you also said that it's important to keep your sugar levels stable throughout the day.
And that's where you have to watch how you're combining your foods and to make sure that you're digesting, absorbing, and metabolizing properly. And this is why I suggest, you know, to my patient, you have a like raw vegetables and protein for breakfast. And most of them kind of go, "What? I can't have my cereal?" And I go, "No. A, cereal is processed. B, it's loaded with the bad kind of sugars, processed sugars. And C, there's not enough protein in it to sustain you through the morning until you have your morning fruit snack. So your sugars, you know, when you eat the by keeping your sugar stable, you're avoiding the spikes and drops in your sugar levels. And this is what happens when you spike your sugars. When you spike your sugar level for whatever reason, and we'll get into this in another topic, but classically, people that are already overweight or people that are under a lot of emotional stress, their hands on the fire alarm in the brain. And their stress hormones are up. Well, when your stress hormones are up, you become what's called insulin resistant. That is, for any given amount of, because whenever your blood sugar goes up, your body secretes insulin in response to that. Well, when you're insulin resistant, for any given elevation in blood sugar, you're going to dramatically increase the amount of insulin that you secrete in response to that rise in blood sugar. Well, insulin is lipogenic. Its job is to deposit fat. It's to store energy for future needs and uses. So you can only imagine when your blood sugar goes up and you have a dramatic insulin response, it drops two things. It drops your blood sugar, but it also drops your blood sugar in favor of fat production or fat deposition. So then what happens?
So
when your blood sugar plummets, you start feeling bad, and you go and eat again, and you spike your blood sugar back up, and you repeat the spike and valley feature throughout the day, and people wonder why I'm not eating that much. How can I be gaining weight?
Let me understand this properly, though. You're saying that if I'm under stress, which everyone is, and I'm eating sugar, then my insulin levels spike?
Yeah.
And then my body, instead of consuming the energy, it's conserving the energy and it's storing fat.
And fat. Mm-hmm.
And if I don't eat anything, which is exactly what happened with your patient, who's my client, years ago when she was in a corporate situation, I was always saying to her, you can't go through the whole day without eating.
Correct.
You can't just have an apple all afternoon and miss lunch. So what happens to the body when someone does go from breakfast to dinner and they've eaten nothing?
Because remember, our brains are 50,000 years old, And our pattern has always been that of a hunter-gatherer society, which means that, you know, our food production was, our food source was never guaranteed. So that in periods of famine, just prior, you know, when food started getting scarce, the body kind of goes, oh, I got to start depositing fat because the starvation time is coming up. Well, what happens when you skip meal? You're signaling the brain, hey, starvation time's coming up. We're entering a period of famine. You better store some fat. That's number one. So, you know, so when you skip a meal, you're signaling the brain, famine is on the horizon, store fat. Number two, what are you doing when you're skipping meals? You're creating enormous physiologic stress. Well, the brain doesn't care whether the stress is emotional, physiological, physiologic, psychologic. It doesn't care. Stress is stress. And when the fire alarm goes on in the brain, the cortisol levels go up. When the cortisol levels go up, the insulin resistance goes up. And guess what you're going to do? You're going to deposit fat.
So you'll say, even if I don't eat, my body produces more cortisol and continues to store the fat.
Correct.
How does skipping meals, though, put stress on the body? Or stress, how does it create a stressful response in the brain?
It's physiologic stress. You know, now instead of having, your body is very dynamic, and it's very well balanced when you give it the proper energy. It's a lot easier for your body to take glucose out of the bloodstream and convert. When you can take one molecule of glucose, one molecule of a fatty acid, one molecule of a certain of proteins, and you can convert it into 36 molecules of energy, which is great, very efficient system. However, if you now have to go to, you know, by skipping meals, and your blood sugar has to be maintained in a fairly narrow range throughout the day in order for your brain to get fed. Your brain loves glucose. It doesn't do well on anything other than glucose. It can survive on keto acids, but it doesn't do well on them, which is why the ketogenic diets tend to make people a little foggy and irritable. Things that tend to be very like no-carb diets, the Atkins diet, the paleo diet, which is a very good food plan. They're both good diets, and they're both good food plans, but you got to make sure you got enough calories in them.
If I'm the average person listening, I could easily get confused because you've given out so much great information. But to walk away with a couple of nuggets that I can apply in my life right now,
okay,
what would you give out as the 3 to 5 nuggets of wisdom?
One, get rid of processed foods. Two, get rid of processed foods.
Okay. 3 and 4 and 5.
Get rid of processed foods. If you get rid of processed foods. Don't skip meals, and don't mix your proteins with your carbohydrates.
We'll come back to that one. So number one is don't eat processed foods. Eat food that looks like the way it grew on a plant.
Exactly.
It's a plant or a tree or fruit, etc. So eat
exactly
the whole food, correct?
Exactly.
Number two, don't skip meals, which means what? 3 meals a day?
Three meals with snacks. Eat something every couple hours. It doesn't have to be huge meals. As an example, for breakfast, I'll typically have maybe a poached egg or two with some fresh tomato salsa. Or I love hummus and celery for breakfast, or hummus and cucumbers. I'll even spot you bacon and eggs, but just make sure it's nitrate-free bacon. But avoid get rid of the toast. Then have a piece of fruit as a snack. Lunch can be a salad. Today I had a Greek salad with some grilled chicken. Afternoon snack that's when you get your dark chocolate, your organic 70% or greater cocoa chocolate. And then dinner, have a sensible dinner, but try not to mix your protein with your carbohydrates, because that tends to delay digestion and spike your blood sugars. which you want to avoid.
So does that mean don't eat fish with your vegetables?
No, you eat fish with your vegetables. Don't eat fish with, the typical steak and potato dinner? Forget about it.
What's wrong with eating steak and potatoes at the same time?
Well, the potatoes are the complex, they're the starch. That's the simple carbohydrate that will, along with the protein, will spike and maintain your blood sugar at higher than normal levels for longer than you need be. And that's going to increase your insulin. That's going to increase your insulin response, and that's going to promote your fat deposition.
How do you go about having a dinner with steak and potatoes?
That's how you go about it, is you don't do it. And once you're at your ideal body weight, you can liberalize this. At one point, I was about 35 pounds overweight from where I needed to be, simply because I was just sitting around. I wasn't exercising because of my back and my neck, and I gained a lot of weight. I just followed this eating plan. I did nothing other than watch how I mix my foods and got rid of the processed foods. I lost 36 pounds in 3 months, and I've maintained my body weight. I haven't had to, and now I will occasionally have a potato with my steak.
So if a person wants to eat meat, is that okay, and how should they go about eating it?
Yes, it's okay, provided it's grass-fed, and that's grass-fed and grass-finished. Some guys will try to sneak it out on you and say, they're grass-fed, but oh, yes, in the last few months we fattened them up with grain. Not good. So grass-fed, grass-finished beef, organic pork, organic chicken, fish, lots of fish, but you have to be careful about mercury content. This gets into the environmental part. So there's a lot of fish I will not eat anymore, and that includes tuna, swordfish, grouper, tilefish, and salmon, unless it's Alaskan wild-caught salmon. Anything out of the North Atlantic is garbage. It's loaded with mercury. It's loaded with PCBs.
So, briefly, if we refer to the movie Forks Over Knives, the premise was to really reduce the percentage of protein in your diet.
Here's the problem with forks over knives. Remember, I've had this conversation more than once. Remember in the very beginning of the movie, one of their basic premises that you had to accept, if you buy into the whole movie, you have to accept this basic premise, was that in the Scandinavian countries during World War II, the Germans invaded, they took away all the cattle and all the sheep and all that stuff, and they took away all the animal protein. And the rates of death from cancer and heart disease dropped tremendously. Right?
Okay.
Okay, this is an observational study. The problem with the observational study is they didn't tell you what they were dying of instead of that, which was starvation and concentration camps. So
you're saying they reduced their meat intake, but they weren't getting enough nutrition, enough nutrients?
They weren't getting enough nutrition. And so what were they, what they didn't tell you was what they were dying of, which I would find to be very interesting. Granted, the rates of death may have gone down from cancer and heart disease, but who knows, they lived long enough to have cancer or heart disease. They may have been dead, instead have been dead from, gunfire or concentration camps or starvation because they didn't have food, or succumb to an acute illness because their immune system was so poor because their nutrition was so poor.
What about the studies that they said they did in Japan or China with
the
hundreds
China
of thousands of people?
Again, interesting study. And I was fortunate enough to hear several people speak. One was the author of the China study along with two other gentlemen, doctors that wrote diet books. And the interesting thing that came out of the China study from my perspective, you're looking at a particular population, the Chinese, and look at their traditional diet. They're trying to transfer data from a specific genetic population set into a universal population set. So I'm not exactly sure that that's quite that's any more meaningful than observational data from the cattle. We took the cattle away and the rate of incidence and the incidence of heart and heart disease and cancer went down. You know, this is a fallacy in logic. In Latin is post hoc ergo propter hoc, after the fact, therefore because of the fact.
Well, your point is valid if you then conclude that the genetics make a difference in what we should and shouldn't eat.
Correct.
Yeah, you're also saying that it's specific to their genetics. Based on your success with your patients, with your clients, is there a percentage of protein from meat or fish that you would recommend?
I kind of like the 40-30-30 mix. You know, 30 to 40% protein, 30 to 40% carbs, and then 20 to 30% fat. Carbs are your vegetables.
But Dr. Mike, you know, for me it's a real challenge to sit there and say I'm going to break it down into percentages. Even though I was the one that asked you the percentages, is there a simple way to live life simply, to remove the stress of fear about what you're eating, and to just eat healthy, enjoyable meals over a week? What's the simplest approach?
Take your plate of a reasonable size, not a platter, not a saucer, but a plate of a reasonable size for your height and weight and body build. Make sure half of whatever is on the plate is raw. And mix the other half with all the different colors of fruits and vegetables that you can find, or fruits or vegetables that you can find. Make sure at least a quarter to a third of it has a good source of protein. If you're a vegetarian, that can be, you know, lentils, legumes, nuts. If not, then, you know, if you're not a vegetarian, then have a high protein, high quality protein fish like an Alaskan wild caught salmon, grass fed beef, organic chicken or pork. So about a third of the plate protein, half of the plate raw, and so you got some cooked vegetables, some raw vegetables, throw in some nuts, some seeds, lots of colors. Fruits are a nice snack.
Basically, what you're saying is take your plate and eat a little bit of everything. Don't eat too much meat and don't mix steak with potatoes.
Exactly. Leave the carbs off of it. Leave the grains off of it.
So, Dr. Mike, the primary recommendations from you are, number one, don't eat processed food. Instead, eat whole foods. Number two, don't skip meals. Eat three meals a day with some snacks in between of fruit. Number four, don't mix steak and potatoes. So don't mix heavy proteins with carbohydrates. And then number five would be to eat a balance of food on your plate with a 50-50 mix of cooked and raw food. Raw food would be salads, I would assume, correct?
Correct.
And so for people that want to truly take charge of their life, you're saying they need to look at their diet, their emotions, their environment, and their present physical state.
Correct.
Are you able to help patients outside of Florida?
Oh, absolutely. See, I have a truly international practice. I have patients from Colombia, South America, from the Grand Cayman Islands, from the Bahamas. I've even had one woman fly from London, England.
Are you able to Skype legally?
I do need initial kind of physical in-the-office consultation. But after that, I'm perfectly able to do it by Skype. Actually, I have one lady moved to France that I still Skype with.
If people would like to learn more about you and your practice, Full Potential Healthcare, what is the website?
It's www.fullpotentialhealthcare.com.
Dr. Michael Bauschmidt, I'm truly grateful. Thank you very much for the extraordinary wealth of information that you've shared today and for simplifying a lot of the confusion that surrounds people when it comes to how do I take charge of my body, how do I take charge of my health.
Oh, you're quite welcome. It's my pleasure, and there's a lot more we can cover.
We will definitely do this again so we can talk specifically about adrenal stress, adrenal exhaustion, and even talk about how anger affects our emotions and affects our physical body. Dr. Mike, thank you very much.
Thank you, Patrick. It was a pleasure.